Radio.
Prosperity Doctrine and the Society We Live In. An interview with Dr. Robert Tilley. This is the second part of a two-part interview on Prosperity Doctrine.
You touched on there, talking about at the beginning that this worldly idea of prosperity doctrine came up during the 19th century. But you also mentioned in there usury, and that is, I guess, something that our current economy is very much based on or intertwined with. Is it any coincidence that something like a prosperity doctrine has arisen in our current social and economic context? And is that perhaps a reason why Catholics today may become, tempted by such a worldly prosperity doctrine, when in the past it may not have been so attractive?
I think what you're saying is true. I'm not quite sure where to begin to answer that, but perhaps one might answer that with a certain sympathy. Prosperity doctrine, as you rightly said, I said, in the 19th century really begins in America. And America, of course, becomes this incredibly individualistic, entrepreneurial society that oftentimes appears to worship wealth. This isn't an anti-American bashing. Clearly, other countries, including England and Australia, share the same things. But in America, it seemed to become writ large. So that in the 20th century, we had a spate of positive thinking books, how to influence people, think positive, and all those sorts of things. And I think you're right to say that prosperity doctrine, that it's no accident that prosperity doctrine should arise within a culture, within an economy that is dominated by usury. It was Marx's point that there is a continuity between base and superstructure, meaning by that there is a continuity between the economy we live in and our culture. Now, Karl Marx, unfortunately, was a materialist determinist. But nevertheless, we can take of his insights and we can see that the form our economy takes will shape, to some degree, the way in which our culture forms, the way in which we understand value and meaning. Now, it goes deeper still. And again, I think Marx is a very good diagnostician of what occurs. A number of authors more recently use the term precariat, as in precarious, the precariat. What they say is that more and more people, the dominant amount of people, the majority of people, we all live in precarious circumstances, something that was clearly made evident in the financial crash of 2007-2008, in the global financial crisis, the GFC. Suddenly, many, many people realized that even if they were not consciously playing the stock market or the money market, nevertheless, events overseas could have very dramatic effects on them. Suddenly, people woke up to realize all their super had gone. Suddenly, they realized that some of their investments, even their house, was now under threat. Now, that's what it means to be in a precarious situation. And I think that all of us, to some degree, grow up deep down understanding that things are unsure. And I think especially, I think people below the age of 40, below the age of 30, and below the age of 20 and 10, because our culture is becoming more and more precarious. There was a very good book published this year by Michael Lewis called Flash Boys, which is about high-frequency trading. Just simply to say that most trading nowadays is not done by people, but by algorithms in what are millionths of a second. In short, fortunes can be made and lost in a split second. I think many of us deep down understand that. And when we look at our culture, at things like abortion, the fact that human life is no longer sacred, but can be sacrificed, as it were, to our consumer desires. Or when we look at the rampant consumerism, rampant debt, that all of us, I guess, are informed with, that very few of us actually own family homes because most of them are mortgaged and thus prey to the financial markets. I think when we all understand that, I think all of us are informed by a sense of the precarious. All of us are, as the authors say, the precariat. In light of that, I think it only natural that many people look around for something secure. And they look around to matters religious, to the Catholic faith, for example. And they look at it and they think, well, God is God, and God can be my guarantor, and that is true. But unfortunately, we start to look at God as if he's just the greatest trader, the one who knows all the ins and outs, the great insider trader that will give us all the tips and make our position financially secure. But it's that very way of thinking that God wants to save us from. And that's what is incredibly difficult. So yes, Catholics are tempted. Protestants are tempted. I guess the wide world over, everyone is tempted. And I think this is what happens in situations like ours. Ultimately, the temptation is to magic. What used to be called theurgy. The idea that you can move God to your desires. But that is not the case, of course, and God has to save us from ourselves. I want to say something else about that because I think it shows the incredible graciousness of God. And this has to do with the parable of the prodigal son, which is in Luke, of course. We should always remember that when the prodigal son had gone to the far-off country and when he decided that he would return home to his father, his decision, according to the parable, was not made on the basis that he suddenly repented and thought, my God, I've been wicked and callous and really, really greedy. What he thought was, the pigs that I am feeding are eating better than me. And back home, my father's servants eat better than me. So I'll go home and I'll say, oh, Father, I've sinned against you and heaven. Take me back in. In short, the son's primary motive was, of course, the fact he was hungry and felt degraded. And yet, God being gracious, nevertheless, those motives too are honored. Of course, they're not honored insofar as God fulfills them, but God changes them and turns them around in order to make that more earthly desire into a heavenly desire. So I think, yes, there are many Catholics now who face the temptation of thinking of faith almost in magic terms. But nevertheless, I think that God's grace is such that those people too will, I think, have those motives turned to the greater, more holier, higher, more healthier motives. So in answer, I suppose, one, no, it is no coincidence that the idea of a prosperity doctrine should arise in an economy thoroughly informed by usury. And no, it's no coincidence that Catholics too should be tempted. All of us live in an unsure world. All of us are either precariat, or at least most of us. And consequently, that should make all of us gracious towards others, not so quick to condemn others, because we really don't realize, I think, how deeply we are influenced by the economy under which we live and to what degree our culpability is diminished because of that. So,
what may be a bit of a difficult question, and this would be my final question, is if we're approached by someone who is encountering difficulty, because this is usually where the scenario would come up where they would say, oh, I'm suffering and I don't know what to do. Say they might be religious or they might see you as religious. What should I do? What is the solution to this problem? And it's here that we're often tempted to say, well, or the thought to go through our mind that maybe they don't have enough faith. How do we respond in that situation to a person? I'm not expecting you to come up with a very in-depth answer because this is a very complicated topic. But how do we come up with an answer that is, I guess, consistent with the message of Christ and with the true message of the gospel?
The first thing I'd ask, are we talking about someone who is a Christian, a Catholic, or someone just generally?
I guess for this question, it would probably be someone who's a Christian or a Catholic.
Okay. I guess that is difficult to answer, not least because each person, I suppose, has their problems in a rather unique way. What I mean is that there are probably, when one thinks about it, only a very few problems, but how those very few problems apply to individuals can greatly differ. What should we do? Look, I can only speak of my approach, and I suppose that's of what I know and what has helped me greatly. I think one of the things that is really important to understand is that oftentimes it is not that person's fault. I should explain what I mean by that. I mean by that that oftentimes those persons are victims themselves, as it were. And again, I need to explain something more of that. What I mean is that one of the great problems, and I think this informs, I'm not going to go into, but I certainly do think it informs a fair amount of suicides. What happens is that people often feel an abyss within, a void, an emptiness. And they try to counter this by pumping themselves up. Think positive, be positive, because after all, people don't want to be around someone miserable. I don't want to be around someone miserable. And they start to think, there's something wrong with me. There must be something wrong with me. When in fact, oftentimes they should be thinking there is something wrong with society. What I mean by that, clearly if someone is acting immorally, then yes, they are acting in a wrong way. But even then, the church understands by reference to moral theology that there are degrees of culpability. Clearly, if someone has been brought up among violent, vicious, evil people, then one cannot expect that they will have the same moral formation or strength or ability as someone brought up in a good, loving household. Obviously, what would be a mortal sin for those brought up in a good, loving household, brought up well, is possibly not for those who are brought up in bad circumstances. That does not mean there are not moral absolutes, there certainly are, but how those moral absolutes apply to individuals is another matter. That's why we have moral theology. Today, many people feel a void, a depression, and they think that faith equals a feeling of certainty. They have been trained in our consumer society to follow their feelings. Feelings are good, but they must be subordinate to the faith, to reason. If you follow your feelings, you're like an addict. The drug at first will be very pleasurable, but very quickly you will only be taking the drug to stop the nagging. And that's like feelings, like passions, like desires. They are good in their place, but if they are not reined in and subordinated to reason and to morality, they will destroy you. Unfortunately, our consumer society works by indulging your feelings, by pumping them up. And that can only go on for so long. After a while, you will feel nothing. You will feel depressed. And if you've thought that your faith is merely a feeling of certitude, well, you'll feel uncertain and you'll think, I don't have faith. But that is not true. And that's why I mentioned St. John of the Cross on the dark night of the soul. I actually tend to think that that should be a primary text in high schools, in churches, and so forth, because it will show you that oftentimes your lack of feelings or your feelings of depression are very important times of the work that God is doing deep down in you. I think people, what I try to have them understand, which is what I struggled to understand for many years, is that our economy informs a good deal of our feelings, a good deal of the way we think about ourselves and others. A good deal, it shapes our consciousness, our sense of value and meaning. And if we understand that oftentimes the horrible feelings that we have are not in fact originating from within us, but in fact are feelings that, as it were, that are imposed upon us by our economy, I think you'll start to realize that things look a little bit different. You will start to use the cliche term, but I think is appropriate here, to feel empowered. You will start to be able to do what is often called within Marxist circles, or used to be, an ideological critique. You will start to reflect upon the culture of our society and start to see just how wrong it is, how misleading it is. That's what I think people need, at least to some degree, to hear. That in fact, it is not solely their problem. It is not solely their trouble. And that if they understand that there is a way of reading the society around them, then I think they will find themselves feeling a lot better. And probably some of the best places to begin to read about this critique of our capitalist consumer culture are in fact the encyclicals and other writings of not least John Paul II, St. John Paul II, and Benedict XVI. I would also point to Pope Francis's apostolic exhortation as well. I think that if people really seriously read a lot of what our contemporary popes have written in terms of social critique, especially something like St. John Paul's Gospel of Life, if they really read it and they took it to heart, I think then that they may not be quite as gullible, quite not as accepting of the standards of our dominant economy and culture today. And I do think as a consequence, they would feel a lot better and their faith would become a lot stronger.
That was an interview with Dr. Robert Tilley. And for more interviews, talks, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.